Well, we've come down to the positive aspect of our study on money and finances from the Bible. And the next point I wanted to look at, it may be the only point we look at tonight, is the proper way for us to acquire our money and goods. In other words, we have to have it before we can use it properly. Well, there's a proper way to gain it also. Sometimes people gain material things to their own hurt. Either they go about it wrong, and so they get it with a bad conscience, or they allow it to affect them in a negative way, and so they're worse off by having it than they were by not having it, because of the way that it feeds bad attitudes or behaviors in their lives. But there are proper ways to acquire money and goods that the Bible would tell us. There's one primary way, but there are a couple of less common but yet legitimate ways. One way that we can acquire money or earthly goods and still be doing what is pleasing to God, not offending Him, is by honest gifts. And I have to say honest gifts because some gifts are of a corrupting nature. You know, they're given with strings attached or with a purpose to influence us in the wrong direction, especially things like bribes and things of that nature. But there are such things as honest gifts. Someone, out of the goodness of their heart, feels led just to say, "Here, I want you to have this, and I pray that God will make it a blessing in your life." And it does meet a need, and it does help. And there's a number of places where you have examples of that. One person I thought of was Abraham, the father of the faithful. And way back in Genesis 25, of course, we know that Abraham had two primary sons. First one was Ishmael by his handmaid, Hagar. And that was really trying to take God's work in his own hands, and that led to problems. And eventually Hagar and Ishmael were put out of the home after the true son, Isaac, was born of Sarah, his true wife. And they went their way, and he became head of kings and peoples. But then after Sarah died, and of course she had borne Isaac in her old age, Abraham, took another wife named Keturah. And she had a number of children, we find in verses 2, 3, and 4. And, of course, their children had children. But we find in verse 5 that Abraham gave all that he had unto Isaac. Isaac was the son of promise, and he received the inheritance. And yet it says in verse 6, "But unto the sons of the concubines which Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac his son while he yet lived eastward unto the east country." So he gave them gifts as his children, and yet the inheritance, as I say, went to Isaac, the child of promise, and in whom the line of Abraham was continued, and through whom the Messiah was to be born. Another instant like this is 2 Chronicles. You have Jehoshaphat, and it tells about his death and how he was succeeded in the throne by Jehoram, his son, who reigned in his stead. And he had other sons as well, and they're listed for us in verse 2. And verse 3 says, "Their father gave them great gifts of silver and of gold, and of precious things with fenced cities in Judah, but the kingdom gave he to Jehoram because he was the firstborn, so he was in line for the throne. He became king after his father's death, and then the brothers of Jehoram were given gifts. Now both these cases are gifts by fathers to children, but that's not always necessarily the case. We have an instance in Esther chapter 9, verse 22, where the Jews gave gifts to one another based on God's great deliverance in their lives as a people in a nation. It says, as the days wherein the Jews rested from their enemies, and the month which was turned unto them from sorrow to joy, and from mourning into a good day, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, and of sending portions one to another in gifts to the poor. And that's often an occasion of giving gifts. One, a happy occasion of celebration, and you just want to share the joy and spread the cheer. And other cases where they had been blessed and prospered, and they wanted to give of what they had to those who were less fortunate, did not have as much as they did. And so they sent portions to each other, and then special gifts to those who were poor. Now Proverbs 17:8 gives a statement about gifts, how they can be something used by God to bring great blessing and help, something that can be of benefit. A gift is as a precious stone in the eyes of him that hath it. Whithersoever it turneth, it prospereth. Now, whether it's talking about him that has it before he gives it, here's a case that's unusual. Usually we give things away that we have that we don't really value that highly, or that are extra and we don't really need anymore, or we don't want, or we've used it up or whatever. Would you like to have this? Here's a case of where they have something precious and they give that as a gift, which is a token of affection when you give something that's of value like that and that means a lot to you. But if it's talking about the gift being in the eyes of him that to whom it's given, in other words, it's something of great value to them and something that they find necessary, that meets a need in their life, and so it becomes very precious to them. In that sense, just like a jewel or some other precious stone that we think of as of something of beauty and great value. And again, whatherever it turneth, it prospereth. A gift given at the right time and in the right way to the right person is really a means of conveying help and benefit and blessing. And I think that's the idea there. Wherever it turns, it prospers. And so, again, a gift can bring real advantage and benefit. A couple other places. Even in the New Testament, Paul commends giving of gifts, especially to those in need. First, to the poor saints in 1 Corinthians 8:4. Yeah, 2 Corinthians 8:4. He's talking about the Macedonian churches who were in a state of double trouble. They were having suffering by persecution, and they were also deeply impoverished as a result. And yet, at the same time, they were experiencing great joy in the Lord, and they had a heartfelt desire to give generously to the needy Christians in Judea. And that's what made their giving so extraordinary and what made it so precious to Paul. He was very pleased and blessed by their spirit, their attitude. I mean, that's the last time you think you're giving, when you're in in great trouble and in great poverty yourself, that's when they gave, which again is what we call sacrificial giving. And they were giving beyond their really ability, out of a willing heart. And verse 4 says, praying us with much entreaty, or begging us with great, you know, earnestness, imploring us, you know, beseeching us that we would receive the gift and take upon us the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. In other words, they wanted to contribute something toward alleviating the poverty and suffering of the Christians in Judea who were being persecuted and as a result were lacking in their worldly needs. And it's called a gift. They did it because they wanted to, and they gave of what they had to help those who were, well, I would say normally less fortunate, but here's a case where they were no better off than the people they were giving to, and yet they wanted to give. One more is Paul talking in reference to himself. Philippians 4:17. He was, of course, in prison, unable to provide for his own needs. And he's telling the churches of Macedonia again, Philippi, that when he was in Thessalonica, they were the only ones who sent to provide for his necessities, as they gave him financial and material aid so that he could carry on his ministry as a missionary. And again, this was a voluntary giving toward his work. It wasn't that he was ministering to them and they were returning for him for his services. He was ministering to someone else and they wanted to make sure he had what he needed so he could do that. And he calls it a gift. Verse 17, not because I desire a gift. As I'm not writing to you this because I'm saying I want you to give more to me, but he's saying I desire fruit that may abound to your account. And of course, he's not rebuking them or saying they did something wrong. He's thanking them and commending them and expressing his appreciation that they would communicate with him regarding giving and receiving as no other church did. And so he was very grateful for their help. Well, that's one means that we can acquire money or goods, gifts. Another is by just inheritance. And a just inheritance means we are really legally entitled to what is left to us. It's everything is honest and proper, and we're included in someone's will, and they leave us something as their wish for us to have it before, you know, that they included us in that will before they died. Proverbs talks about that. Proverbs 13. Even finding something is not necessarily a valid way to acquire goods, you know. Finders, keepers, losers, weepers, they say. Well, if someone lost it, it's still theirs. If we find it, it's our duty to try to make sure that they get it back and do everything we can to get it returned to its rightful owner. But here's a case of the will of the owner is expressed that when he dies, he wants us to have something. Proverbs 13:22. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, and the wealth of the sinner is laid up for the just. So he says leaving an inheritance even to grandchildren is an action of a good man, which would mean it would be a good action. It's being set before us as something that is proper, an act of wisdom, which the Proverbs is all about, godly living. Chapter 17 and verse 2 says, a wise servant shall have rule over a son that causeth shame, and shall have part of the inheritance among the brethren. In other words, if you have a son who you'd normally think would get the inheritance, being someone that's very wicked and irresponsible and undutiful, in other words, he doesn't relate to his parents as he should, and he doesn't treat them well, he may find himself left out. Where if you have a servant that's respectful and obedient and trustworthy and diligent and really cares about his master and his interests, that servant may find himself in the place of the son And in where you would expect the son, the servant may come in and may and would even be included in the inheritance among the brethren, where you wouldn't think a servant necessarily would be left an inheritance, but in this case, he was such a servant that he would find a place in the master's heart, and he would be remembered in that way. Chapter 19 of Proverbs. Verse 14 and 15. House and riches are the inheritance of fathers, and a prudent wife is from the Lord. Slothfulness casteth into a deep sleep, and an idle soul shall suffer hunger. And that might be the guy who sits around thinking, well, when my parents are gone, I'll get the money, and I'll be set up, and I'll be okay, so I can kind of slide through and take it easy and wait till that happens. Well, that may never come to them. And God may not allow them to see their hopes realized. But house and riches are something that fathers leave to their children. And, of course, a lazy child that's not willing to do his part and carry his weight and, you know, fend for himself may be excluded and disappointed in the end. One more, Ecclesiastes 7. 11:12, wisdom is good with an inheritance. The margin says it may mean as good as an inheritance. Words, if you don't get an inheritance, if you have wisdom, that'll make up the difference. But it's saying wisdom's a good thing, and it brings an inheritance alongside of it as also a good thing. And by it there is profit to them that see the sun. For wisdom is a defense, and money is a defense. Right, there's the inheritance. But the excellency of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to them that have it. In other words, wisdom is far better than an inheritance. It can give you what a dead person can't leave you, life. And wisdom certainly is the better of the two. Okay. So, those are two legitimate ways when everything is as it should be. There's no corruption and iniquity mixed with it. But the most important and the most proper way for us to acquire our money and goods is, of course, by good, hard, honest labor. Working with our hands. That's what God has ordained, and that's what God blesses. Genesis 2, right from the beginning. Boy, I wish Adam and Eve never sinned. We wouldn't have to work. We could have sat around all day eating fruit. Well, even before they sinned, God made sure that they were going to be employed profitably so that they weren't going to be idle. And he put them in a garden not just to lay around and eat, but it says, verse 8 of Genesis 2, the Lord God planted the garden eastward in Eden. And there he put the man whom he had formed. And it describes the garden and all the trees with fruit in it. And verse 15 it says, and the Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. Yes, if Adam and Eve hadn't sinned, there wouldn't be the toil and sweat and the pain and struggle that we have that attends our work. But they would have worked. If sin never had entered the creation, work would have been a part of man's experience and occupation. And so that's something that God gave right from the beginning. He gave man as man, not man as a sinner, man as man, work. And so it's for our good, and it's God's will for us. Chapter 3, of course, talks about after the fall, after man had sinned and disobeyed God, work took on a whole new character. There were a lot of negative factors involved with it. Verse 17 of chapter 3 says, unto Adam he said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Right, so the ground was cursed because of man's sin, And the curse basically entailed sorrow, toil and labor and suffering in his bringing forth food from the ground. And he would have a lot to contend with that would resist him and make it more difficult. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee. And that takes no work at all. That's part of the curse, and it comes on its own. And it says, thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread till thou return unto the ground. For out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto the dust shalt thou return. So, sorrow, toil, struggle, sweat, and labor, and death, all were added on to work to make it to be a punishment in the sense that it had all these negative factors involved with it. You had to struggle and labor to maintain your physical life. That life would end, and then the body would return to the dust that you had to work so hard to eke out a living from. Now, does that mean work itself is a bad thing? No. It just has many difficult factors involved with it because of man's sin. All right, now let's look at more expressions. When God gave the commands to Israel, again, he reemphasized the importance and necessity of work. Of course, it's in the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. Verse 9, 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. All right? God divided man's time up into 7 day weeks. Six of them were to be occupied and utilized for labor. You see the same thing in chapter 23 and verse 12. 6 days shalt thou do thy work, and on the seventh day thou shalt rest, that thine ox and thine ass may rest, and the son of thy handmaid and the stranger may be refreshed. 6 days out of seven given to work. So evidently work is meant to take up a large part of our time in this world, and it requires a lot of work to be able to get by in this world and have our needs provided for. It doesn't come easy. Proverbs chapter 10. We'll look at some of the Proverbs now. Verse 4 and 5. He becometh poor that dealeth with a slack hand, but the hand of the diligent maketh rich. There's a hand is given to represent that by which we do things, by which we labor. And our hand needs to be diligent if we're going to gain a return for our labor that will enrich us for the things we need. And he gives an example in verse 5. He that gathereth in summer is a wise son. Or when it's time to be doing the work, to have what you need when the time comes, that you're going to have the winter and it's not going to have food readily available. You had to have planted and harvested and stored your food to be able to get through that time. You need to be working. Otherwise, you're going to get caught. You can't just slack off and let things slide, and then all of a sudden say it'll be there when you need it. He says, but he that sleepeth in harvest is a son that causeth shame. Hey, it's harvest time. Get out of bed and get out in the field and start getting to work. Otherwise, shame will be your portion. Chapter 12, verse 11. He that tilleth his land shall be satisfied with bread. You're going to have bread. You need to do some plowing and do some planting. And then you get a harvest of wheat by which you can grind your grain and come up with flour to make your bread. A lot of steps in that process, isn't it? A lot of work all along the way. But if you do it, you'll be satisfied. You'll have enough to eat and get by. But he says, he that followeth vain persons is void of understanding. I can't plow. My buddies are going out. to the ball game. You know, we're going down to the bar. We're going to watch a movie, or, you know, we're going to go out and have some fun. Get together. Well, don't expect to be eaten next fall. That's the only problem. Chapter 14:23. In all labor there is profit. See, there's God's promise. Work brings a return. No labor, no profit. And so if we labor, God promises to bless that. But the talk of the lips tendeth only to penury. You can talk about what you want to do and what you want to get and about doing jobs and working all you want. It won't accomplish anything. It will not bring you a paycheck. Talk is cheap, and so is the pay it brings. As a matter of fact, it brings nothing. How about chapter 22 and verse 29? Seest thou a man diligent in his business? Right? Watch a man who works hard at his job. He shall stand before kings, he shall not stand before mean men. There's a man that's going to be recognized and appreciated and promoted and put in positions of responsibility. And that usually brings greater income. He won't be found among, you know, the obscure and lowly, the poor, but he will be found in a much higher society because his own work will exalt him to that position. That's the idea. A diligent man is a man will find himself going places and having opportunities open up to him. Chapter 27, verse 18. Whoso keepeth the fig tree shall eat the fruit thereof. You like figs? Keep the tree. And it'll bear fruit for you, and you can eat that fruit and enjoy it. Don't keep the tree. Don't look for fruit. It takes all that work to before the fruit comes. So that he that waits on his master shall be honored. You want to be honored? You want to be recognized and be given special rewards? Then do what your master requires. Work and be a good servant. And your master will appreciate that, and he'll express that in different ways. And you'll be blessed by those things he does for you in appreciation for your faithful service. Chapter 28, verse 19 is kind of like the other one we looked at. He that tilleth his land shall have plenty of bread. Very simple concept, isn't it? You want to have enough to eat? Till your land. You want to go hungry? Don't till your land. Don't do the work that you need to do to bring forth your food from the earth. You won't have it. And then, what will you do in the end thereof? Where will you go? Who's going to feel sorry for you and want to help you when the only reason you're hungry is because you wouldn't even do what you could have done to provide for yourself? But he that followeth after vain persons shall have poverty enough. Now you go in around with the wrong crowd, the lazy, good-for-nothings, you'll join them in their poverty, and they won't be there to be able to give you a hand when you need it, because they won't have anything to give you either, because they were not tilling their land when they should have been any more than you were. And so you can all share in your poverty, just like you shared in your folly, by fooling around and playing games when there was work to be done. Well, we don't want to leave the ladies out. Proverbs 31 talks about a godly woman. And certainly one of her main characteristics is she's a hard worker. You know, verse 10 says, who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. How do you prove that? Well, you figure out what your wife does. If she's a godly woman, she's a hard-working woman, figure out what she does, figure out if you had to hire out to have it done, and then see if you could pay her. You think so? I don't think so. I don't think anyone here is rich enough. to pay for what our wives do for us every day. Well, it gives a lot of examples through Proverbs 31. I won't go into the specifics, but notice like verse 13, she seeks wool and flax and works willingly with her hands. Or she enjoys her work and she does it gladly. Not forced, but voluntarily. Verse 27, it says, she looks well to the ways of her household. She eats not the bread of idleness. She's not sitting around being lazy and idle. She's busy constantly. And it's very true. A man works from sun to sun. A woman's work is never done. She has no bread of idleness in her bread box. None at all. Verse 31 says, give her the fruit of her hands. In other words, acknowledge and recognize all that she accomplishes by her labors, and let her own works praise her in the gates. And if you haven't recognized it yet, I'm doing that right now. I praise our women for their hard labors around the home and all they do in raising the children, guiding the household, and caring for the family. And it's certainly a great work. Another place it tells us what our attitude should be in the way of work is Romans 12:11. We're to be not slothful in business. All right, whatever our business is, make sure it's not attended with laziness. Let's be diligent, you know, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. So not to be slothful, that means to be hardworking in our business. Ephesians 4 says that not to work is to be a thief. Why? Because it's by work we gain what we have. And if we don't work, then we don't have it's any legitimate claim to have our needs met. And so when we get things, we're robbing. Verse 28 says, let him that stole steal no more. What do you mean by that? Stop stealing. Well, it says, rather let him labor. See, if we don't labor and earn our own bread, then we become a charity case. Someone has to take care of us and provide for us. And yet, we're not a legitimate charity case, because if we could be working and we're not, then we have no one to blame but ourselves for not having what we need. And so in that sense, they shouldn't be given anything. Because the only reason that they're not provided for is because they're unwilling to work and do what it takes. Now, we're not talking about people who can't work for various reasons. You know, they're physically disabled or whatever. But if we can work and we don't, we're really stealing. The opposite of stealing is laboring, working with his own hands, manual labor, the thing which is good. Or is working is a good thing. And it says that he may have to give to him that needeth. See, by working, you're in the giving category. By not working, you're in the taking category. And certainly it's more blessed to give than to receive. And that's why working is more blessed than not working. One main reason. 1 Thessalonians 4. Here's some commands that Paul gives the Thessalonians as Christians, that you study to be quiet. When was the last time you did a study on being quiet? That means don't be a problem and trouble. And to do your own business. Right, don't be a busybody. And to work with your own hands as we commanded you. Because when you're taking someone else's work, they're working with their hands and you're taking the fruit of their work instead of working with your own hands. He's saying work with your own hands, not so we could be independent, you know, I don't need anybody, in the wrong sense, but in the right sense, God doesn't want us being sponges, you know, that depending on other people for what we can do for ourselves in the way of work. Work with your own hands as we commanded you, so that you may walk honestly toward them that are without. Working makes us, gives us an honest testimony to the unbeliever. And so you may have lack of nothing. Isn't that a great statement? Work with your own hands so you can be a good witness and lack nothing you need. Second Thessalonians says a lot about it in chapter 3. We can read beginning at verse 7. For yourselves know how you ought to follow us. Paul's saying, you know what you should do to follow our example or our lead, to imitate us. For we behave not ourselves disorderly among you. First of all, we weren't disorderly, so don't be disorderly, because that's not anything that we set before you as an example to follow. But what's he talking about? Neither did we eat any man's bread for naught. Right? There's such a thing as eating a man's bread for nothing. How do you do that? In other words, we were eating other people's bread when we weren't doing anything ourselves to earn that bread or contribute toward earning that bread. And so we were taking from others what we had no claim to or right to. But he said, we wrought with labor and travail night and day. Hard work all the time. That we might not be chargeable to any of you. We did not want to make ourselves a burden to you, to cause you to have to pay our way. Not because we have not power. Now here's a special case. These are ministers of the gospel who could have been supported by their preaching, but he's saying we did not use that because we wanted to show you how to work yourselves. We didn't want to give you a bad example and give you the wrong idea where you thought, hey, Paul and Barnabas, they just preach and they get taken care of. Why should we have to work? Well, here's what he says. He says, not because we couldn't require you to support us, but to make ourselves an example unto you to follow us. What a great heart. His idea was, these people, they need to see a diligent Christian life, and I'll set that before them rather than just taking their support so they'll be able to say, there is someone we can imitate in our lives. That was outstanding. He says, for even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat. So maybe there was a real problem with that in this church. And Paul thought, I can easily tell them, if you don't work, you don't eat. You know, do as I say, not as I do. But if I really want that lesson to come across, I better work so that they'll see it in my life too. I'll practice what I preach. And then I'll have a double effect. For we hear that there are some which walk among you disorderly, working not at all, but are busybodies. Now them that are such, we command and exhort by our Lord Jesus Christ, that with quietness they work, and eat their own bread. There's the command. With no less authority than Jesus himself. Don't be a troublemaker and a busybody. Quietly work and then eat your own bread. Don't be depending and sponging off others when you could provide for yourself. And he says, this is well doing. But ye brethren, be not weary in well doing. Now, why is it that labor is the proper way for us to acquire money and goods? How come it works out that way? That when I work, I gain a return, some remuneration that provides for my needs. Because that's how God set it up again. That's exactly the way he ordained it. That work would be rewarded with pay. Leviticus 19:13. Thou shalt not defraud thy neighbor, neither rob him. The wages of him that is hired shall not abide with thee all night until the morning. In other words, God says, you make sure that when you hire someone to do a job, you pay them a fair wage for that job and that you pay them promptly. So what's God saying? Pay brings salary. Or reward, what the Bible calls wages or hire. Luke 10:7, Jesus taught the same thing. Now here's a case where he's talking to preachers. He sends them out to preach, and he says, don't take with you any extra provisions. Why not? Because you're doing a work, and you'll be taken care of for the work you do. It says, verse 7, and in the same house remain eating and drinking such things as they give. Well, wait a minute. I thought you weren't supposed to eat and drink for naught. Well, he's saying if you're preaching, that's not eating and drinking for naught. You know, in other words, he had called them and commissioned them to this work, and he would make sure that he'd raise up support and help so they could be provided for to do that work. And how does he describe it? For the laborer is worthy of his hire. Go not from house to house. And of course, Paul applies that in 1 Timothy to elders being worthy of double honor. But here's the whole concept. That's a basic principle of creation. God has ordained it that the laborer is worthy of his hire, or that work should be rewarded with pay. And by that pay, we can have our needs provided for. And one last thing, when all things are as they should be, we also gain a good night's sleep by our labors. That's Ecclesiastes 5:12. And that's a great reward in itself. You know, if you're sitting around all day and not expending much energy and not getting tired and, you know, napping off just from lounging around and not really being active, and then you can't sleep at night because you didn't get tired and you already napped a few times, even if it was unintentionally, it doesn't allow for much sleep. But Ecclesiastes 5:12 says, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. And certainly a good night's sleep is a great blessing. And to be able to tie that together with this morning's message, God says, I will both lay me down in peace and sleep. As if I've worked hard and I've earned a good rest, I can lay down in my bed with a good, clear conscience and go to sleep and not feel guilty that I've squandered and wasted my day without being profitably occupied in gainful employment. For thou, Lord, only makest me to dwell in safety. So work is a good thing. It's a necessary thing, and it's required of us by God, and He promises to bless us for it. That is the proper way for us to acquire money and goods, is to labor with our hands. And God will make sure that we're taken care of as we do.